This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday, whenever. And also, Happy New Year, everyone. Happy New Year. Joined, actually, one of the last times Nastassi's going to be joining us from California, because she's headed back to our coast pretty soon, right, Nastassia?
No.
I thought you were coming back in January.
Yeah, you change your mind? Might be extended because my... Well, we can talk about it later.
Yeah, nice. Well,
I mean, why would I go back and
I'm glad to know that my business partner like doesn't even tell me, like, you know, on air I hear, you know, no. All right, whatever.
It happened like last night.
Happy New Year! We got John in his Connecticut booth, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and Matt in his Rhode Island hidey hole. How you doing?
Hello, hello. Doing well.
Yeah. All undisclosed locations. I'm the only one who'll say exactly where I am. Lower East Side. Come down to Grand Street. We'll fight. I'm kidding. We won't.
Actually, I'm sure Joel will say where he is, too. He just joined.
Oh, hey. Long time friend of the show, Joel Gargano in here from Chester, Connecticut. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm actually home in Clinton right now.
Wait, I thought you were in Deep River, your house. You moved to Clinton?
We moved. We bought a house in Clinton because, you know, kid and all.
Is it because when you were in Deep River and you went to Chester, all the Chester people were making fun of Deep River constantly, and so you're like, I can't live here, we can't do it?
A lot of my staff grew up in Deep River, so they have some strong feelings about that argument. So.
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know and don't care, like on the left side of the Connecticut River, which is, it's not actually the, I always thought it was the most important river in Connecticut, but Connecticut's got like three or four main rivers. Anyway, Connecticut's one of them. And on the left side of it, there's these little towns, like really nice little towns, one of which was Chester, where I used to have a place and where Joel's restaurant is, Grano Arso Restaurant. And then just south of that is Deep River, and these two towns have kind of a rivalry, and the Chester people, even though Chester is like also like a nice, it's not like ritzy, it's just nice. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of ideal for someone like me. It's not like the Upper East Side. It's like if you divided New York into zones, where do you think Chester would be? In New York City.
where would Chester be? Well, I mean,
yeah,
Murray Hill.
I would say probably maybe West Village.
West Village,
yeah.
and then that would make Deep River then would be like the Bowery or something.
Alphabet City, maybe.
Yeah, all right. Back when Alphabet City, back when you could still get murdered in Alphabet City. So anyway, also, congratulations on the relatively new one in your family there, Joel.
Thank you. Her name is Swan, and she's an absolute gem.
Oh, beautiful. Awesome. Great. Yeah, well, it's all joy. Now, before I get a couple of questions that we had, by the way, so Joel's an expert in making both his own pasta and also in grinding flour, fresh grinding. We had a couple of questions in. So rather than me speculating and kind of like, you know, weaseling my way through these two questions that we have, we figured we'll just have Joel on. We'll ask him. And then you get the answer from someone with some experience. And secondly, we wanted to check in and see how what the kind of current COVID environment of business is up there in Connecticut.
Well, I'll start with the business stuff. So way back when last March, everyone was kind of in, you know, freak out mode. So it took a little while for us to figure out what we were going to be. So once we figured out that we can do some family style takeout stuff, you know, that eventually worked out pretty good until we were able to reopen and do a parking lot restaurant, which actually was pretty great. In Connecticut, at least where we are in Connecticut, people are pretty respectful. So that was kind of nice to see that people did the masks and didn't complain that much. We had once in a while you get a few one-offs. You just want to bark a little bit at the host, but other than that, it's been pretty good.
That's the crew from Newington, Berlin and Newington came in.
Yeah. They roll right on with particular hats on their heads and say certain things to our staff. So
just so you guys know, like, coastal Connecticut is an extension of the line between, no offense to coastal Connecticut, but it's an extension of the line between New York and Boston, all right? So like that's who, when people are like complaining about us East Coast elite people, like they're part of that, whether they're blue collar or whatever, they're part of the thing that the rest of the country hates, right? That's us. But then like literally 35 minutes to 45 minutes north, just above what's the Middletown line, if you're going up the Connecticut River from the Long Island Sound, right? It completely changes. Coastal Connecticut's gone. You know what I mean? It's like, am I right about this, Joel? What do you think?
You are exactly right. And I'll leave no comment on that. But yeah, it definitely goes into a different zone, just a few miles north of Chester. That is absolutely correct. So
by the way, my favorite place in Connecticut is right where the line is, a place called Portland, Connecticut, which is a real rundown, like, well, I shouldn't say that, but it's a community that has seen better economic days. It's across the river from Middletown, right? And mm-hmm. in it is my favorite water park ever, Brownstone. Have you gone to Brownstone, Joel?
There's a water park up there? I had no idea.
Oh my God. Once this COVID is over, you got to go to Brownstone. It is a brownstone quarry where they quarried, you could guess, brownstone. And at some point, I think in the 20s or 30s of the last century, it flooded and couldn't be unflooded because they build quarries next to rivers a lot. So it's right on the other side of the Connecticut River from where Middletown, where that old bridge is. Yeah. And it flooded and no one knew what to do with it. So at one point, someone was like, hey, let's open a water park. And it is amazing water park. It's got like, I don't know how, but there's like an amazing group of people. Everyone's fun. It's like, you know, like all different kind of people, all different kind of ages. And it's not like Action Park. If you ever heard of Action Park in Vernon, New Jersey, or seen the recent documentary on it, the most dangerous water park of all time, where I actually went when I was a child. You know, everyone wears a vest. Everyone's fairly respectful, but it's still kind of crazy. Like you could still jump off of a cliff in a quarry into water. Amazing. Go wow. when the world reopens. But anyway.
Hey, John, we should grab our Speedos and go next weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know when they're gonna open. I was gonna go this summer, but obviously not. You know what I mean? If any of you are from the area and want to go, the power move once people are allowed, once people would ever be seen near water that someone else had been in, the power move is to get a group together and rent one of the gazebos. There's gazebos that, like, the entire place is decks, and you walk out on these floating decks, and then you can kind of just do whatever you want. You make a day of it, right? And you can bring your own food. Don't bring liquor, I don't think. But you can bring your own food, and you rent this gazebo, and your crew then owns this gazebo for the day. You could just camp out. You spend a whole day there.
Wow. This is like the most dad suggestion I think I've ever heard you say.
Hey, it's fantastic. Look,
I believe it. No, it's funny.
For those of you that don't know, you're never going to see me. I wore a bathing suit to this place. I did still wear a shirt because, you know, I don't show skin in public. But like, they got me to wear a bathing, and I was happy to be there. So for me to be happy to be at a place like this, I mean, that says a lot. And unlike Sesame Place, no offense, Philadelphia, this place does not smell like a poorly attended male gym locker, right? You know, or like, you know, when you leave a towel and you wash the towel and then you don't dry the towel, and then a week later you open the dryer and you're like, oh, that, right? Sesame Place, I'm not saying it smells like that, but it smells like that. You know what I'm saying? Sesame Place is a water park near Philadelphia. Anyway, I love Sesame Place, no offense, but, you know.
That's not really coming across in that description.
What, the lack of offense? The one negative thing I'll say about Brownstone is this. That when you are approaching Brownstone, you're like, whoa, I don't think I'm going to like this because right next to it on the other side of the street, right on the where the river is, are like a bunch of like oil storage tanks. Because for those of you who've never been to Connecticut, much like New Jersey on the waterfront, at some point in the 20th century, someone decided, hey, what if we took everything we had that was pure and beautiful and surrounded it with petroleum? Right. And so like anywhere you go in Connecticut where there should be beautiful, except for where Nastasia's house is, not that she's ever going to go back, apparently, although I didn't know. But everywhere you go where there's supposed
Steve,
to be something.
I'm going back. Oh! I want to clarify to everyone. I'm going back. It's just the idea of sitting in my house on the water by myself in the winter and then being out in the sun near my family is like, you know.
Yeah, the choice seems pretty clear.
Wait, Nastasia, not now, but tell me when we can tell the story of the windows. Anyway.
You can tell it. Yeah, and that's the other part of it. You can tell it.
All right, well, let's finish this. Every single beautiful place in Connecticut, at some point, someone has tried to ruin it with either a raised highway where they take 95 and, like, cut through all this beautiful stuff, or they put some sort of giant gasoline storage there. So you can kind of – when the wind changes direction at Brownstone, but once you're in the quarry, you don't smell it, but, like, when you're up top, you're like, eh, meh, meh. You know what I mean? Anyway. So business, you're saying they're being respectful, but like what's happening now that it's turning winter time?
So, okay. So obviously we had to close out our big parking lot restaurant. So we put a few tables out front and most people don't want to sit outside. We get a few people that don't mind and we have our little propane heater. You ever see these ones? You can get them at Home Depot. They look like Johnny Five from Short Circuit. And they have basically, it's like two big eyes and there's a propane and just lights up. We just wheel them over to the table.
Right.
And they can get their personal heater and they're like $50 a piece.
But they're not the overhead. They're not the overhead umbrella infrareds that.
Yeah, they don't have that kind of money, man.
Yeah. Plus, those things are like twice the cost of what they used to be. You know what they're doing in New York City now? I don't even know how these are legal because they've New York City has converted outdoor dining back to indoor dining. So the coolest setup I saw is someone bought a bunch of those portable greenhouses and just stacked them one next to each other.
Yep,
so to keep the heat in. And so here's the thing, like all of those people are indoor and then the poor server has to show up and deal with a bunch of hopefully for the, you know, bank accounts of everyone involved, extremely liquored up. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like people like spewing crap into the server's face. I still feel bad for the servers, but that's how we're dealing with it.
This is definitely something that has shown a lot of our industry and in a couple of ways what we're capable of doing. Obviously, we're made to think on our feet, but on the other side of things, financially, that you get a little more thrifty than you think you could be. You know, I didn't think that we'd be offering the food that we're doing out in a parking lot on picnic tables, and people would be throwing down upwards of $100 a person before service charge or gratuity or whatever. And they're happy to do it sitting on a picnic table, which is amazing to me. So that's the kind of community that we do have, and we have the plus side. And I know there's a lot of other restaurants in the state and here in the country that are doing a lot worse than we are. So it's such great people to come support us through all this stupid mess. But now that it's cold out, we have people inside. It's not the most popular thing, to be honest, but our staff is really good and they take, the utmost precautions. And if anyone gives any sass, we give it right back and or kick them out. Funny story, we had a guy show up the other day, right before service started, and wearing a body camera attached to a lanyard and started picking a fight with the hostess. And she's 16 years old, by the way. It's like, geez. So you're a grown-ass man picking a fight with a 16-year-old hostess about putting a mask on. So we're like, okay. So
and the body camera is just so he can prove to all of his friends what a douchebag he is?
I'm pretty sure this was like he was trying to collect content for his Facebook page or something. Our manager, Haley, came over and squashed you pretty quick. And I had just turned the corner as this was happening. And the funniest part about this was we had someone picking up a takeout order while this was happening, and the bottom of the bag was wet. There was 2 quarts of marinara sauce in that bag that just hit the floor, exploded all over the host area while this guy is harassing our young hostess. So if you can imagine this moment of like, what is going on with you? But those things that happen are so few and far between that, when they do, we're just kind of like, you're crazy. Just get out. So when that does happen, we kick him out. So it's not a big deal.
Had a lot of fun cleaning up marinara sauce and
Luigi came in handy. Yeah.
Hopefully it was in a quart, not in glass. Let me ask you a quick. Why can't you ever notice with quart containers? And for those of you that
they're not worth it. Have you noticed this? They've gotten worse.
Yeah, they are more brittle than they used to be. It used to be, so quart containers, like where we come from over here, everyone uses quart containers, and they're not environmentally unfriendly because you use them 8 million times. And by the way, for any of you that order soup from people or whatever, and someone hands you a quart container, don't throw that away at home. You can use that thing forever, right? The one caveat is that if you freeze in them, they are extremely brittle. But recently, the quart container batches I've been getting have all been brittle even at room temperature.
You can't, you know, when you got something kind of solid, you gotta squeeze, you gotta get a little squeeze to get it out.
Yeah.
You can't do the squeeze anymore. You give a little squeeze, the whole thing shatters. Game over.
Yeah. And they separate in it, like there's a disc line separation around the bottom that I've been cracking all the quart containers on. I don't get it.
How do we get to the bottom of this?
They're polypropylene. Nothing should happen to them, right? Like polypropylene is a great plastic for this because A, it's lack of, you know, plasticizers, the fact that it doesn't leach, the fact that it can handle relatively high temperatures, like way past boiling, without degrading, like all of that. But suddenly I've just been so disappointed.
We found one brand from one of our vendors, Trimark, that you have to call our sales rep and say, give me this specific one or else they'll just pick whatever and send it, right? Because they got a bunch of different brands.
Right.
But this one seems to be of the old style. So I can give it a solid squeeze and it doesn't shatter.
I like that. I'll give you an example of this just happened to me last week. So Dax, who's 15, like, of course, I mean, kind of like me actually, fidgets constantly, right? He fidgets constantly. So we're at the dinner table and he's taking, I had a, you know, so you don't just buy quarts, you buy quarts, you buy pints, and you buy some 8 ounces, right? So that you can efficiently store things of different quantities. So I think I had an 8 or a 16, you know, and I had this Greek yogurt in it. And Dax kept on spinning the yogurt around on the table. I'm like, Dax, nothing good can happen from spinning this. The only things that can happen are bad things, right? Spillage, whatever. So he kept on doing it. And so finally I went whack and I hit the container down onto the table to stop it from spinning and shattered it. Yogurt everywhere. Yogurt everywhere.
Definitely imagine.
Yeah, classic me story. I was like, I told you nothing good could happen. And so what happened is you pissed your dad off. He hit the yogurt container down under the table. Now there's yogurt everywhere. See? So I was.
Are these things I have to look forward to?
Yeah. Well, you know. Okay. So these are the cooking questions. Although, hey, quart containers was relatively cooking related, cooking tangential, cooking adjacent. So I feel like we've gotten some cooking stuff in. And Nastasia, remind us, we'll talk windows at the end. Trevor, I have two questions for you. Trevor Driscoll wrote in, and I was wondering about the virtues of fresh milling flours for pastas. Have you experimented with milling your own grains for pasta doughs, and does it generally have a similar impact as it does when you're baking bread? Cheers, Trevor. And P.S., we gave him some advice that the rice cooker was, in fact, not just a superfluous luxury, and that they would use it more and more. And he says, P.S., the rice cooker has become a crowd favorite, and that purchase is no longer contentious. Well, I'm glad you're never going to really – I've never met anyone who's like, I wish I didn't have this rice cooker. I never use it. Crazy. Anyway, so you got an answer for me, Joel?
Sure. So, hi, Trevor. Well, we've done a bunch of different stuff at the restaurant, Grana Arso, with freshly milling grain. When it was part of how we opened, it was part of the concept of the restaurant. So we went through a few different iterations. I think the two camps that you're going to fall into, and I'm assuming he's a home cook. He's probably going to be making sheeted or rolled pasta, not extruded, machine extruded pasta. So I'll go into the extruded stuff first, just so he has a point of reference. But the problem you get into, and it's not impossible, the problem you get into if you did 100% a freshly milled flour through an extruded pasta machine is that if it's not milled finely enough, it'll get caught in the dyes, and then you're having a big, big problem. So what we do is we actually sift out the bran and germ after the mill, and we just have a tabletop mill. It's a Kumho tabletop mill, and we set it to as fine as possible and pass it through and then sift out the chunkies, and then we use that flour to make our pasta dough. The hydrations do change. Typically, you need just a touch more water, even if you're sifting. So you have to play with your ratios a little bit. But anyway, it is possible. The only problem you run into with using freshly milled flour is that your product, if it sits, as we call in the restaurant, on mise en place, if it sits for too long, it will start to oxidize. It changes. In fact, we've noticed it gets gummy. So I would suggest if you are extruding.
You think that's due to enzymatic action?
I don't really know. It could be. I'm thinking it's like partially fermenting even maybe. I don't really know. Because we're not at the restaurant, we're not freezing extruded pasta. So it just sits in the cooler until we use it. So you imagine, you know, with your prep schedules, let's say you have enough pasta for 2 days or 3 days sometimes, and you, or you want it to carry the weekend and see how it is on Tuesday. It has completely changed color. It gets dark brown, and it's really not that appetizing. So what we've done at the restaurant is actually much lower the amount of whole grain fresh milled flour we put into and use mostly semolina. And we've adjusted this since we opened just because of that, because the product was degrading so quickly.
But when you did cook it though right away, did you like fresh milled wheat in bread just tastes different. I'm not saying it's better. I like it a lot. That's what I use now, but it's just tastes different from AP flour and makes whole wheat flour that you buy seem like some sort of like terrible bad joke that people are playing on you, right? Like, yep. do you get any taste effects like that?
I mean, it definitely tastes, again, you know, like, I guess it depends, you know, like what kind of flavor profile you're looking for. Pure semolina, just regular General Mills semolina has a almost nostalgic flavor to most people. It's delicious on its own right. And it's kind of neutral to whatever preparation you're doing. Versus if you're going to freshly mill grain, you know, you're going to want that to be a predominant flavor and not just kill it with, you know, your marinara sauce or a basil pesto or something that you would make at home normally. So I would probably do different preparations if you are going to do that to highlight the flavor of the grain. Now that's just extruded stuff, but with freshly sheeted pasta or rolled pasta, typically you're making a dough with eggs in it. That you can get away with whole grain without sifting the flour, but you are going to have just a little bit less pliability, I think, with the dough. But definitely you have to up the hydration or the amount of egg you're putting in. At the restaurant,
you don't regrind the bran. Even at a fine setting, the bran's pretty big. If you're going fine on your rollers, it's going to cause tear out sometimes, right?
Correct. Yeah. And we've done that. We just think, because we actually at the restaurant, we have other purpose for the bran and the germ. So we find other things to do with it. We actually reload it back into our bread. So let's say we're making a pasta dough and we sift out the bran and the germ. We'll take, we call it I forget what my baker calls it, the scrap or something, the trim of it. And he takes it in and throws it back into the bread. So it's had a purpose. But for the roll pasta, that's a better bet for the freshly milled flour. I would suggest it, but if you're not going to use it right away, put it in the freezer. So we actually do this as practice at the restaurant. It does not degrade the quality, in my opinion, of raviolis, all that kind of stuff, because we're going through it in a day or two anyway. All it does is set the dough so it doesn't, you know, the moisture doesn't leak out of the filling and yada yada. So actually using freshly milled flour helps the structure of the ravioli. So it actually, for the dishes that we do, it actually helps. And we do this with rye. So we add up to 10% of freshly milled rye.
That's crazy. Rye is so sticky. You don't have problems with it?
Not at all. It actually firms up the dough. So, but again, we're only using 10% and the rest of it is 00. So that amount actually firms the dough up enough. You have to up the hydration again, just a tad. And we get a fantastic product out of that. You make great garganelli, you know, tagliatelle, fettuccine, yada, yada, all that stuff.
Now, Nastasia, you're not against fresh egg pastas and fresh ravioli, right?
Right.
I'm not. Yeah, you're okay. But, you know, I'm sure Joel knows by now that you're, in general, you are a commercially produced dry pasta lover and have taken a stance against most fresh pastas. True?
Right.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I just really don't like them. And it feels like if you're going to have a shape other than like fettuccine with bolognese sauce or something, it should be dry, because when I eat shapes, it's just like a big mound of dough in your stomach. And I spent a lot of time in Italy and going back and forth. And it's like, I love dried pasta. I prefer
it. What about like tortellini and brodo? You know, you got noodle, you got, you know, stuffed pasta.
Sure. They're really That's tiny. Fine. And I said stuffed pasta is fine.
Yeah, Nastasia is not against things that she thinks are intended to be fresh, right?
Yeah, that is intended to be fresh. You can't do it any other way.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Also, Nastasia, the way that I have received what you have said, not just about this argument, but all arguments are, like, sometimes big companies do a great job, let them do it.
Yeah.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. And actually, Dave, I'm going to make a plug. We're opening up a dry pasta company this year. So that's a big thing. We purchased the equipment. We have this gigantic pasta extruder from Pasta Biz that we got in a drying cabinet. So that's the real deal way to do it. The guys at Pasta Biz are great. So
and
help us kind of source all this stuff out.
I anxiously anticipate trying some of your wares. And if you can, I would love to hear... Because Nastasia won't give any proprietary information out, obviously, but like, you know, if you talk to some of these old school Italians, they're like, the drying rate. But then they won't tell you what exactly the effect is or what they do, because everyone has their secrets and they won't tell you. So I'm hoping that, you know, maybe if you do some experiments on drying rate on these pastas that you can, you know, maybe tell us what's actually going on with this stuff. Might be fun.
Yeah, I've never dried pasta commercially before. We've done, you know, sit by the windowsill kind of thing. And that usually does not yield great results. Yeah. So especially with extruded pasta and the low hydration, it's actually really difficult to do it. So the drying cabinets are pretty dialed in. There's cycles it goes through and it's like super hot, you know, it goes up to like 130 degrees or something. I'll know once I get the damn thing plugged in and figure it out, but it's sitting in a crate right now. Anyway, so that's kind of where we're going. And it's a good opportunity for us to try to transfer the style of pasta we do at the restaurant and really see if it works with drying, you know, and particularly using rye, because we love using rye in our pasta. It's in our bread. It's all the stuff. It's one of our favorite grains to do, because when we do our toast on it, the grana arso kind of flour, instead of burning, you know, quote unquote, burning the flour, we toast the whole grain in a cast iron pan until it smells like you put Cheerios in the toaster oven. You know what I mean? Like, get kind of this burnt, oaty kind of smell. We chill it and then pass it through the mill. And you get a really fantastic, flavorful product. So we're going to try to see how that translates into drying. It might not work. We don't know. We'll find out.
Well, I anxiously anticipate. Now, there's one more question for you. And before that, I'm going to, like, insert here, because there's a lot of confusion, I think, even people who know a lot about exactly what semolina is and durum and why you would use it. So Nastasia, expert on this from the, you know, all the pasta business. Joel, you are, but I'm going to insert something and then you can argue about what I say. So semolina, right, is a grind, right? So it's a grind. And what it is it's got very few fines in it. In other words, like, it's not supposed to have any dust, or very little dust as possible, because you don't want to have a lot of dusty, damaged starch, because that stuff absorbs water like a mother, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's going to, like, make you have to have a higher hydration dough to make it machinable, right? Mm-hmm. And so then the other thing about durum is that durum wheat, which is a wheat now, not a grind, so you can have durum flour, right? You don't have to just only get semolina out of it. You can make durum flour, right? But typically people are buying the semolina from durum. Durum is an extremely hard wheat, right? But the gluten in it, right, is not such that it's going to stretch back as much as a... Because you could also whip mill semolina from a regular, like, spring or winter hard wheat. But mm-hmm. if you do that, you're going to get so much, like, shrink back on your stuff that you're not going to be able to kind of extrude properly. You need it to hold together, have enough protein to have good bite, but you don't want it to be snapping back. You don't want the you know, the snap back that you would get in something where the gluten system was extremely stretchy, right? So that's why you want an extremely hard wheat. And by the way, the hardness of wheat people associate it with high protein. Not true. It is a different protein. It's not the gluten protein that makes the grains hard. And they've done the research over the past 15 years. It's a different set of proteins that cause the wheat to be hard. But you want it to be very hard so that it shatters into these kind of large chunks. And then these semolina chunks, which can then be formed into a relatively low hydration and also not, you know, you can stretch it out, but it doesn't snap back dough. And that is why durum semolina is the sine qua non of pasta flour. So would you both of you say that's relatively accurate?
Accurate.
Yeah. All right. So the second question. Pasta related question. And before I get to this, I had another question. Someone wants to start grinding more meat. I have the question here somewhere. While you have it, do you have any recommendations for, you know, relatively inexpensive, like, you know, next level up from the KitchenAid meat grinder? That, you know, maybe, I don't know, like the Hobart is what everyone gets, the Hobart that's about the size of a small ice cream machine. But is there one that's cheaper that works that you've tested or?
No, we go traditional Hobart. In fact, I think the cast iron thing that attaches to my 20-quart mixer is probably 30 years old, but it works great. Although I will, and I don't have a recommendation, but I will put in a formal complaint to KitchenAid that the food grinder attachment, the blade on that thing is like basically a paper clip that they've melted down into make it look like some sort of like knife that you're supposed to put in this thing. Is completely garbage. But you know what's really good for is that if you're going to make an emulsified style sausage, it actually does a good job at mashing the meat and the fat together.
Because so it's such a smear machine?
It does the opposite of what it's supposed to do. But if you're making an emulsified sausage, it'll actually do okay.
Oh, nice. All right. Yeah. Zach C. Put this chat room question in before. Mid-pandemic, I was somehow able to convince my partner that an Arcabaleno AEX5, now that, people, is like, if you live in a house or want a small pasta machine in a line on in a restaurant, right? It doesn't have a lot of output, but I've been jonesing for one of these things for years. It mixes and then extrudes, and you can get all kinds of cool dyes. It is, as the British would say, an awesome piece of kit. Anyway. I was able to get the AEX5 as a critical tool to survive sheltering in place. It's been amazing. One thing I find challenging is that the only real recipes for extruded pasta are aimed at commercial/industrial scale, where the main goal is to end up with dried pasta. So this is going back to our dried pasta question. Do you know, and this, since you have not yet been a dryer, Joel, you will know this, do you know of any resources that have recipe guidance for extruded fresh pastas? I want to better understand how things like different flours, eggs, moisture, etc., impact the final product. And then a bonus question, I'll probably handle this one, unless you're one of you guys are welders. I have a tank of welding argon at my apartment because sometimes a man's got a TIG. My roommate and I hypothesized that we could displace the air in an open bottle of wine with the argon to prevent oxidation. It didn't work. Should this theoretically work? Yes, it should. You're just not delivering it right. All right, now back to the pasta question.
Wow, sometimes a man's got a TIG. I like that.
First of all, like when you run a TIG, there's a certain amount of air in the line. So yeah. If you have the argon thing, if you're actually using the torch, the TIG tip, right? You got to run it for a little while. Don't, you know, you want to make sure that you're not going to build up pressure in the bottle. Some of those early argon things will cause the bottle to shatter. So you're going to want to run it for a while before you even do the injection. And then you're going to want an in and an out. And you want the out to be outside of the bottle and the in to be in the bottle so that it's transferring all the stuff out. Anyway, go ahead.
I wouldn't call it an argument, but something inside my head that knocks around a lot. Why extrude pasta that's supposed to be dried, but then just go around and turn it fresh? Does the texture change? Absolutely. I think it's just a completely different product. So when people come into our restaurant, they're like, hey, this guy makes all of his own pasta. How cool. They probably don't connect the two dots that if I purchase dried pasta of made with American semolina flour, it probably went through the exact same machine that I use, probably just a bigger scale, but the process is exactly the same. So really all it comes down to is the type of flour you're using and the texture that you desire.
But the pressure on the big machines is a lot higher though, right? Like the screw pressure is a lot higher.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that well also changes the temperature of the dough for which it extrudes, and that changes the product. So for what's this gentleman's name again?
Zach C.
Zach, all right, Zach. So here's your master hydration to start with, 31%. So start with 31% water by weight of your coarse or whatever of your semolina flour. Don't go down the Durham road. So General Mills, okay, classic standard for semolina in America. It does a great job. It's very consistent. Start with 31%. If you want to start to add in some adjunct grains or some spelt or whatever, start with 5%, climb up to 10%. You've got this little machine, so you can have fun. So you can dry it. It does make a different texture. If you don't dry it, just cook it right away. So even if it's sat in the fridge for, you know, 2 days, it'll generally keep around the same hydration. The cook time won't change that much. If you leave it out with no cover, obviously it'll dry out and then it'll change the cook time. But if you do decide to dry it, you can do the by the windowsill method. You can put a small box fan on it. Just you have to rotate the shapes around, because if it's sitting or put on a rack, but you still have to shake them around, because whatever contact point it has, it's gonna stay wetter in that area, so the drying won't be even. But I would encourage him to experiment with both and see which one you like better, because you might like your dried, you know, spaghetti or bucatini product that's your extruding, but you might hate your rigatoni because the wall thickness is different or something like that. And that's something we run into at the restaurant all the time is, you know, how fast can we cook this? You know, because we're a restaurant, we gotta get the food out. So sometimes I choose shapes that have thinner wall thicknesses and pair them with more popular dishes. And if I don't like the texture of the completed dish, great, start, throw it out, start over. But some pasta shapes do take a lot longer, like gnocchi sardi is sometimes an 8-minute cook, even if you just extruded it fresh and didn't dry it. So yeah, I guess it really depends where Mr. Zach wants to land with what he likes. But I would encourage him to try both.
What do you think about Nastasia's comment on the doughiness of a lot of people's attempt at fresh pasta that should be otherwise? Do you think it's just because they don't have a machine that can achieve a low enough hydration on extrusion? Because they use the wrong flours?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, you know, back to what you're saying about the sort of plasticity of like semolina doughs, you know, it just creates a different bite. And that's why I encourage people, if you're going to extrude pasta, you can add non-semolina flours to it, but it will inherently make the dough more gummy, maybe sometimes softer, and some people like that. They don't mind it. I think really it's like shape dependent. I mean there's so many shapes or dyes you can buy for your extruder, but if you don't like the doughiness of it, perhaps maybe dry it a little bit. I don't like adding eggs at all to my extruded doughs. I know there's people that do that. They'll kind of dose their semolina doughs with egg yolk. I feel like they just do it just for color, but I don't prefer the texture that it kind of contributes to that. So I just, I'm a semolina.
Real pasta heads though hate soft pasta, right?
What do you mean? Soft, what do you mean?
Well, Nastasia, you hate a soft pasta, right?
But it's like, an egg.
Like, I'm going off of like Mark Ladner's training, you know, and he's pretty good at pasta.
But what I'm saying is that you hate a pasta that doesn't have a texture when you bite into it. That's what, right. I mean by kind of soft,
yeah.
Right?
You mean like the al dente type?
Yeah, you're just not, you have to accept that you're not going to get that. That's all.
Yeah, well, in the end, but the problem is, right, that when you go harder, when you try to go lower hydration with, and your technique is that doesn't match up to it, I guess you can make it harder, but then the outside gets like almost boiled dumpling looking, right?
Hmm. No? Yeah. Yeah, I think if you're using, let's say, for example, you want to make a sheeted dough. It's got eggs in it. And you do that, you know, you pull out the measuring cup and you get, you know, crappy all-purpose flour, throw in 3 eggs and mix it around, and then you pass it. I think that makes terrible pasta dough. It's not the right flour. If there's too much egg white in it, I think, and it makes it too, like a wrong type of firmness. It almost like souffles a little bit when you cook it. I don't
yeah.
know what
it, yeah, it puffs up. Well, this like the damage, like the damaged starch and the fines and all that are going to inflate, and you're going to get like that, you know.
Yeah. So that's why they're heavier on the egg yolk. I think that's the better way to do it. It makes that.
And you don't want your pasta to end up looking like a spetzel, right?
Although
I love spetzel.
So what we do, we actually sheet our pastas, even if we make garganelli or any of that, that are non-stuffed, we sheet them as thin as possible. We go as before it breaks. They're extremely fragile. That's why we make them and throw them in the freezer immediately, so that way we can portion them. But the cook on them is like under 90 seconds, and we can put in like whatever filling you want, and it basically thaws out in that 90 seconds. Never curdles like you do ricotta cheese or any of that. It never curdles in there, and the texture on the pasta is like amazing. It's super, super silky and soft, and doesn't have that any like bit of like odd firmness to it that you get sometimes with those whole egg style doughs. What the one that I don't like, and I still can't really comprehend, is freshly sheeted chitarra, which is you use that. It looks like a guitar, right? It's a bunch of strings across a board. You have to make a really thick kind of dough, or sorry, like thickness before you pass it through to get this like square cut shape. By the time you cook that thing, it is like a brick in your stomach. So I haven't really wrapped my head around why you would do that. Why not just sheet it thinner and make, you know, a spaghetti style chitarra that's a little bit thinner? It just might be a regional or a
well, but that's an old home cooking technique. People used to have that. They'd string across the board and they'd do it. Did anyone ever do that industrially? I mean, they do, I guess, but I mean, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, you did what you did, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you think about it, why don't you just pass it through a die? I mean, you are going to get a different texture because you're literally forcing it through an auger and it's going to heat up a little bit. But I don't know. I would prefer if that dough was a firmer semolina style dough, not a egg dough, because again, it's like you're biting into like a really hard souffled flour lump. You know what I mean?
You're really selling it there, the hard souffled flour lump. What do you got, Matt?
Courtney BST asks in the chat, can you dry fresh pasta in a dehydrator? I have one at home and would love to give handmade dried pasta away as gifts.
Yeah, you can. I've done it. It does not work great. The problem is, I think that unless you set your dehydrator super low, I still think the fan is like too much. So maybe if you like vented a corner of the dehydrator and kind of let a little more air out, it might work. I've done probably 8 to 10 tests doing this. I've had zero great results. I think you're better off doing an ambient temperature. It just takes longer. So just leave it out on the counter. Make sure it's not, you know, you're not in like, I don't know, like a humid part of the country, or if you are, make sure the air conditioner is on and it's not, you know, just a bunch of moisture in your kitchen, or else it'll take longer. And I would flip the pasta often, move it around.
Yeah, but you need a certain you need a low enough humidity to do it, though. You need a low humidity.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot more to learn about drying pasta, but it's almost like if you dry it too fast, it just cracks and it's useless. It'll look fine. It'll actually look kind of cool. You're like, oh, look at this thing. If I put it in a box and slap the label on it, it will look professional. But by the time you go to cook it, your noodles just, they crack. They fall apart.
People always tell me my noodle cracks. Also, like I said earlier that, you know, I've somehow lost my touch on gnocchi, and you wrote in. You want to give some quick gnocchi tips while I have you on here?
Absolutely. Yeah, I did. Have you tested it yet?
No. I've been working on a bunch of other. Last night I was working on my favorite Bergoloid, the patty melt. My new thoughts on patty melting.
Dave, I'm gonna, before I get to my gnocchi, I'm gonna let you in on something. So every single year, my wife and I, as a Christmas tree decorating tradition, we make your patty melt.
Oh man, the high tech one?
No, the one you made on that you did like an eater video like 10 years
ago.
Yeah.
Nice.
I make it every year. She loves it.
Patty melt's delicious, right?
Delicious. What was the one you put like a ketchup puck in it or something? That was weird.
Well, so the original patty melt I did was just the way that I would do it if I was going to do the best job I could do. And then I made it and Eater was like, no, we came to you because we wanted something kind of like just wacky, something stupid. I was like, all right. And so I was like, what if I, because by the way, like I'm in general on my burgers, I'm a mayonnaise and other kind of, but on patty melt, the answer is ketchup. Like there isn't really a different answer. So if you don't like ketchup, maybe patty melts aren't for you, because the answer to what goes on a patty melt is ketchup. Someone's like, can I put tomatoes on it? No. What you do is you eat. So patty melt, for those of you that don't know, is rye bread, right? You can go seedless or you can go not seedless, but like like New York, like Jewish deli style rye bread. Then you could change the cheese up a little bit, but Swiss, some Emmental style thing. I like Gruyere, whatever. Then like really well sautéed onions and a burger, and it should end up like a grilled cheese. So like the taste of this with some ketchup is great. Anyway, so I did one where I low temped it and all this other stuff. You know, it's delicious. But the one I was working on yesterday was like I was trying to go even kind of lower. So I was doing something closer to a smash burger on the burger, so that the burger was like small but still all the way across the rye. It ended up good. I also though switched my technology from butter on the grilled cheese part of it to mayonnaise, and I think I over mayonnaised it last night, so it got a little bit too greasy. Anyway, I digress. So Ida was like, it's not crazy enough. So then I did a reverse alginate, which typically I don't use these techniques, but I did a reverse alginate ketchup puck, which I then molded inside of a burger, and then low temped the burger, then like flash seared, I can't remember where I fried it or flash seared the burger off, put it inside of the pre-grilled, which is still a good idea, by the way, doing a pre-grilled cheese thing to your patty melt, separating it and put the burger in between the bread that's already been pressed flat with the grilled cheese and the onions is still a smart move. Anyway, do that, and then when you cut it at the table and open it, the ketchup self-sauces itself out, so it's a nice trick. But I don't think anyone's ever going to do that in the real life. That's just because... And then Eater, for as mad as they got at me for not going crazy enough on the first one, they posted both. You know? Anyway. Good times. But the patty melt is... I'm not going to say it's a hamburger, but it's my favorite burgaloid.
For your toast, because I don't remember, do you pre-butter the bread and then put on the griddle, or do you butter the griddle?
So the issue with if you're a butter grilled cheese, and I'm saying, in all honesty, I'm becoming a convert to the mayonnaise the dark side of this, because you know my whole life I've been a butter guy. And there is room for a little bit of change, but I butter the surface on the first piece of bread and then put it down. The problem is when you flip it, it's hard to get the butter all the way under the second piece. And you know that when I was a kid making them, you would just cut little pieces of butter and put them all around and they would kind of capillary wick in, but you'd always have little dry spots, you know, over your bread, which is not what you want, right? So I mean, I'm kind of thinking maybe butter on one side and mayonnaise on the other might be the answer. But I mean, obviously nothing simpler than just spreading some mayonnaise on and putting it down. I can't remember for the video, because at the French Culinary, butter was free and I could just keep a bunch of melted stuff around. I might have done the brush on of melted butter, but I wouldn't recommend that for home just because it's kind of too wasteful for home people, you know?
Yeah, that's an extra step you don't need to do. I just say, yeah. if you're the type of person that leaves your butter out softened to like 24/7, which you should, then it's an easy schmear. I don't know.
Can I tell you something? So Booker goes through an unconscionable amount of butter. Just to give you an idea, like the Liège style waffles that I make, I did some calculations. I think they're roughly a third of a stick of butter. I don't know. There's something ridiculous in the Liège waffles. It's like it's a pound of butter for 13. Anyway, it's crazy amount of butter in it. Booker then adds like a half stick of butter to the Liège waffle in all the crannies. So I lied when I said he only eats sushi and candy. He also, you know, Elvis style consumes, you know, like sticks of butter at a time, and still has an unhealthily low BMI, you know, body weight. Anyway,
he's a growing young man. He deserves butter.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I'm not against the butter. But here's another little thing he has about it is that he doesn't like soft butter. So like I had one of those butter cloches where it doesn't go rancid, where you store it and it puts the butter under the surface of water when it's being stored without getting it wet, so that you don't get oxygen in, so it doesn't go rancid on you. And he's like, butter should be hard, Dad. I'm like, no, you're wrong. He's like, yeah, I don't care what you think. That's the way I want it. So now no butter can be tempered in this house or Booker won't use it.
Do you just hide some like in another room? You can't do that?
I guess. I don't know, but like, again, like, I mean, I have more butter in my fridge at any one moment than most people who aren't cooking professionally at this point. Like, you know, I once I go below 3 pounds in butter reserves and strategic butter reserves, I start getting nervous. You know what I mean? Same with eggs. Like if I don't have at least 24 fresh eggs in my fridge at any one time, I start like, you know, feeling like something bad is going to happen to me. And that's not a pandemic thing. That's just the way I cook. But yeah, I guess I could spare a stick.
Just keep it like underneath your bed.
So yeah, but no sometime one... sometime around 5 or 6, man, maybe even more, maybe like even longer now, I switched from being a butter on my bread guy to an olive oil on my bread guy.
That's also good. Dude, I like when you've been in our restaurant, did you find it strange that we serve butter with our bread in our Italian restaurant?
No, I didn't remember that. I didn't register it. Do you do both?
No, we just served the cultured butter because we do the
cultured butter is delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes total sense. I've always had this like internal fear that one day some super Italian guy is going to walk into my kitchen and shoot me in the face for serving butter with bread in an Italian restaurant. But
yeah, most of that generation is dead. So you don't need to worry about it.
Good point. Good point.
Bujali died like a year ago. So you're good.
So the gnocchi was a bit of an interesting thing we wanted to do at the restaurant. So I prefer the potato gnocchi, not the densey, lumpy flour bomb gnocchi. So we go I'll call the Marco Canora method, which is it's russet potato and 00 flour and salt, and that's it. So we did this method. I've made it 1,001 times. Sometimes you get inconsistent potatoes, blah blah blah, or you're not doing it right. So you turn into a chef on the situation. You start weighing everything, and that's the only way to do it. So you weigh the milled potato. So bake off X amount of potatoes. We have a ratio we follow, and we make sure we cook the hell out of the potato. Like you're going to make baked potatoes for dinner at home, cook them an extra half an hour. Like just leave them in the oven. And then scoop out the guts out of it. The most important part is that you have to be ready. So you have to have all of your everything kind of like your flour out, all this kind of stuff, the salt out. You have to have your water boiling, ready to go, or else you're going to be in trouble. As soon as the dough cools down, it gets gummy. And if you work the gnocchi dough while it's gummy, it gets more gummy after you cook it. So what we do is we pass the potato through a food mill. You can obviously do this with a potato ricer at home. It's not an issue.
Handheld potato ricers, potato ricer attachments for stick blenders sound stupid, are great. Go ahead.
What is this? It attaches to a stick blender?
Yeah, there's a stick blender ricing attachment. It goes in the opposite direction. So it's got like a little food mill, wings underneath. You push it down and it forces it up through the ricer, but it's real quick. And you know, you get those Mont Blanc chestnut, like streams of things coming out of the top of them. You do a couple of hits into it so you're not over processing it, and it's fast and don't have to clean it out. Cause I hate food mills. It's a tool that only Europeans, I think, have. No one in the United States makes enough potatoes for this to be an issue. And so they're very hard to find, but I have a couple, but yeah.
So what we found at the restaurant, because that's what we do. We want everything to work on the pickup. We made a little discovery. If we add just a very small amount of cornstarch to the dough, when we add the flour portion, because we sift it over so there's no lumps, the very small amount of cornstarch makes all of the difference in holding the stability of the gnocchi so it doesn't fall apart. Because the idea is you want as little flour as possible to hold it together, but you also don't want it to, you know, become a total mess in the boil. So after you get your rolled out, you make your gnocchi shapes, you can probably watch 28 videos on the internet of how to roll the gnocchi. And then we boil them in salted water for about 2 to 3 minutes, depending on the size of it. And then we shock them, which sets the starch. So you boil them and shock them, which sounds counterintuitive because you're like, hey, I want to eat these gnocchi now. But you have to shock them because it sets the starch. And then we portion them, do whatever. And at the restaurant, when order comes in, we heat up our sauce of choice, whatever that is. Could be a butter glaze, could be a cheesy sauce, could be tomato-based marinara, whatever. Cacio e pepe style is very popular for gnocchi in the restaurant. So we do this, and you just heat them up in the sauce. Don't reboil them. You don't need to do that. Step saver. Just put it right into the sauce, heat it up together with the sauce, liaise a little fat in there, cheese, whatever, and serve it and eat it. And they're great. They also were good as like after you blanch shock them to make a sort of a gnocchi casserole. It works really good. We do that for holiday stuff. We did this past year. We made like a truffled sort of Mornay bechamel sauce fonduta, and then put the blanched gnocchi in there. So give them instructions, bake it in the oven for X amount of time. And it's like this cheesy, like potato gnocchi pie. It worked really good.
All right. Now, how hot are the potatoes when you're scooping them?
Super hot. You got to burn your hands, dude.
Yeah. So what poor sap does that job? Nothing is crappier than pulling an oven out of pulling a potato out of the oven and then having to get the flesh out of it right now. I hate it.
Yeah. You just got to be ready. Put like double, triple glove up. You got to spend the couple cents on gloves, right? Hold a kitchen towel, you know.
I did some tests on peeling, wrapping, and baking potatoes, but I don't have anything conclusive yet.
Wouldn't it just dry out on the after you on the exterior anyway?
Not if you wrap it. I'm working on it. Now let me ask you this: since you clearly have a lot of potato skins lying around, do you have a good potato skin recipe? Because most are garbage. They come out either leathery, they're not crispy. I haven't gotten the true, like, you know, Simplot style, you know, TGI Fridays potato peel recipe down. You got something for me?
No, we either throw them out or snack on them with a little bit of salt, maybe a little olive oil in the morning. It's a good gnocchi's done in the morning, right? So it's one of the first things you do when we come in. So it's a good breakfast. So we just eat them or throw them out. So no, I don't have a potato skin thing. But most of the time they're like, it's like an oil mop in your deep fryer. It's kind of rough.
I know. And they're never as crunchy as I want. How the heck do the pros do it? Someone out there, let me know how they're done.
Who's a pro at potato skins? You're saying like TGI Fridays.
Yeah. But they don't make them. It's like Simplot or like someone, you know, someone in ConAgra makes those things for them. Right. So, cause that's what they're doing. So, I mean, I just don't know how they do it. I've never had good. This is also, I know a lot of people out there like to make their French fries with the skins on. I don't really understand that because I've never had the skin of a potato that I have worked with get as crunchy as the non-skin side.
But it's the flavor. So you know what? I think, what's his name? Heston Blumenthal did this. If you're going to do a water blanch on your fries, put the skins inside of a sachet and put them into the water and almost make like a potato skin stock and then pull them out and then blanch your French fries.
I mean, I have infused flavors into things when I'm boiling with the French fries. I don't know. Right now, I'm working on the potato chip. Nastasia sent me her favorite West Coast potato chips. You want to call out the brand, Nastasia?
I don't have them here. You have them. When do you want to call it out?
I can't because they're up in a thing. I'd have to go leave the show.
I don't know.
And we'll talk about it next time. But Nastasia doesn't mind a dark chip. She likes a hard, and not hard in a bad way, because sometimes hard means bad in fried goods, but like crunchy. She likes a crunchy AF, like, and doesn't mind it dark. So like kettle style, crunchy, thick chip.
She likes thick and crunchy. They taste kind of burnt. You can tell when they're kind of burnt. That's no good.
I mean, I don't know. This is an argument. Yeah. Listen.
Are you guys against the Cape Cod chip? That's like the gold standard.
Cape Cods are relatively blonde. I think they must be putting a vacuum on that thing to getting them blonde. You know, we used to, when we didn't want things to color up, we would just hit them with acid beforehand, right? But in the current test that I've been running, like I would put like six different potato chips out. And Dax, Jen, my wife Jen, always went for the ones that she doesn't like a greasy potato chip. She's not afraid of consuming infinite amounts of fat, right? She'll guzzle the oil. That's not the problem. She doesn't like greasy chips, right? And I'm emphasizing the Z to emphasize, you know, why she doesn't like it, greasy. Dax, interestingly, because I wouldn't have pegged him for this, is interested in maximum potato flavor. So the like OG kettle style, which are fundamentally just chipped directly into the fryer, he always prefers those, even though they're darker in general, because he says they have the most potato flavor, which is something I haven't thought about before, versus all of my blanch ones, you know?
That's a good point.
I think the average person's not going to make a potato stock to do their blanching with, but, you know, maybe. I don't know.
Does anyone on this call, do you guys wipe your hand while you dip potato chips on your shirt? Or pants? Or do you grab a napkin like a polite person?
Okay, so the shirt is always a bad call because people can see your shirt.
Yeah. But do you do it like instinctively? Like it's just the closest thing to wipe your hands on?
No, I just leave my hand. What I actually do, like when I'm testing in the real life, what I get is I'll eat, my hand will be filthy, I'll hold it in the air, and then I'll walk over to the sink, use the foot pedals, and wash it off.
Oh, okay. Well, foot pedals are nice.
I'm going to do a thing eventually on foot pedals. I have to do something on foot pedals because they're awesome.
Well, and then the company that you use for all the parts will change on you, and they won't sell the parts anymore.
I know, right. I know. Well, John, speaking of it, do you have the information on the new company that you're recommending to replace Mark Power? I haven't had the heart to call any different company and actually run through all the part numbers to see what the changeovers are, but...
Well, so when I spoke to Mark Power's or the company yesterday, they recommended Master Marketing Sunlow, S-U-N-L-O-W, but I'm not quite sure it fits the bill. We need to look into it a little more.
So depressing. Look, if TNS Brass goes out, and by the way, here's something I'm going to say about buying equipment. Once we know people are starting restaurants again and you're buying equipment, or even at home, maybe, I mean, you know, commercial faucets are different from something else, from home ones in some ways. Every contractor, I don't understand this. I don't understand whether contractors get paid off by crappy faucet manufacturers or what. But you're paying so much money, right? And they're always going to recommend that you get a cheaper faucet. Always. Cheaper angle stops, cheaper faucets, right? And the truth is that TNS Brass, who's, you know, far from ever giving me anything, if they, you know, as a company, like they've always been kind of a little bit of jerkweeds because they won't deal with humans directly. TNS Brass is phenomenally expensive if you pay retail. There is no reason to pay retail for TNS Brass. And you often don't, especially as a cook when you're, you know, because you have a lot of other things to worry about. But if you just go online on eBay or anywhere else, you can get TNS Brass, not like at half off, you can usually get it at a third of retail, right? And then just hand it to your contractor and be like, install this, because I'm not going to say anything bad about Fisher or any of the other crappy faucets, Crown, the ones that other people try to sell you, but they will work fine for 6 months. And you'll be like, see, there's no problem. And then they will start to break. Other people's foot pedals will start to break. The faucets won't shut off right because the people that you hire to work in your restaurant are going to be brutal on that faucet. So like a high quality faucet that you can depend on and whose parts are easily changed is a blessing. I don't know. What do you think, Joel? What do you think about high-quality faucets?
I mean, definitely. The problem that I see, especially within restaurants, because I'm going to bring that up all the time, is that if you buy it, there's someone there to break it. Literally within probably 14 seconds of that item arriving, so someone's going to break it, no matter
right,
what.
Like a real TNS Brass, if you can afford to wait and look on eBay and get one, they're so robo. If you've ever used the really nice chrome, really thick TS Brass faucet stuff, and they're the real spray arms, they're so robo. Yes, they'll still get broken, but it's going to take, instead of 30 seconds, it'll take like a minute and a half, and you can replace the parts. They're serviceable.
Yeah.
And for God's sakes, get your contractor to screw the dang faucet down firmly. Because once things start spinning and they're not firm anymore, then people brutalize it as it hits the beginning and the end. Another thing, go quarter turn. I know I've said this on angle stops a million times. But if you have valves on your faucets that are multi-turn, people will gorilla them at both ends, which is going to very quickly ruin your valve, and those ones strip out a lot faster, right?
Yeah.
So if you get
totally agreed. Yeah, it's terrible. I did quarter turn all the way. Right there.
Quarter turn. And, you know, I'm going to say something that's a little counterintuitive. I like the wrist handle ones because they're just less filthy, but it is true that, you know, but they're easy to gorilla. You could put a lot of force on a quarter turn with a wrist handle, but I find it superior from a sanitary. Maybe I'll do a video on it at some point. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's L-A-R-D-E-R, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
This episode is supported by Nourish and Flourish. Nourish and Flourish features behind-the-scenes stories about artisans, producers, farmers, growers, and other makers in America, along with delicious and wholesome recipes. The latest issue of Nourish and Flourish is a special artisanal gift guide showcasing some of America's finest products, including everything from the farm and garden to eco-friendly home goods, kitchen and cooking essentials, bath and body, original art, blown glass, seasonal recipes, and so much more. Shop online to support local and buy local. Together, we can make a difference. Learn more at nourishandflourish.site.
We gotta go pretty soon, but Devin asked for a clarifying question. He said, yes, for Joel, when you said pasta dryer is 130 degrees, did you mean Fahrenheit or Celsius?
What? Oh, I was referring to what someone told me because I haven't tested my gigantic pasta dryer yet, but it goes up to 130 Fahrenheit. That's around, I think, where it caps out for the initial, and then it cools down for the rest of the drying. But it has to go through, like, I don't know if it's like trying to like flash off a bunch of moisture that's on the pasta, and it just has to evacuate really fast. I'm not really sure behind the science behind that because I'm just diving into it now. But if you're going to use a dehydrator at home, I would certainly go as low as possible.
Yeah,
but it kind of mimic like, you know, it's a nice tempered day. You know, it's mild out. Try to mimic that sort of climate in a dehydrator.
Look, there's another issue, right? That needs to be addressed on a dehydrator. Air temperature is not a valid way to measure this stuff. You need to know the relative humidity. So that's going to be the difference between the wet bulb and the dry bulb temperature. And no small home dehydrator, Excalibur style, has a way to measure the relative humidity. So if you're at 130 degrees Fahrenheit and you're, you know, and 100% humidity, right? So let's say Louisiana, right? Like that is going to be a much different experience for the pasta than being at 122, let's say 122, something that could happen in Louisiana, although it doesn't, that's not that hot, but versus 122 in Phoenix at like 8% humidity, your pasta is going to experience something very, very different from a drying standpoint. So the temperature, when you're talking about especially low temperature drying, specifying temperature as separate from your humidity isn't going to give you anything reproducible. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know why no one's cracked the thing where they deal with both, especially because at the low temperatures at which you're dehydrating, it's relatively trivial to at least tell you what the number is. It might not be relatively trivial to control it, but it's relatively trivial for you to know what the number is. And since Devin did write in, I'm assuming this is Devin Patel, Nastasia, it's late, but Devin wanted Phil Bravo to sing Dreaming of a White Christmas. Do you think we can get that next year?
No.
Why not? You don't think he'll do it?
No, I already asked him when I saw that question come in.
Oh, and he said no?
No.
Yeah. All right, well, we have a year to work on him. And also, Devin would like Jackie Molecules to know, right? When he's going about spending the on wine on a date, the amount or price of wine purchased is an investment. So a cheap bottle is like one night, and 50 bottles is like a marriage proposal status. But I don't really know what that means. And if you're investing, Devin, in a nice wine so that you can get someone thinking that you are good, that could be an investment that lasts a lifetime, right? Right? I don't know. And they also wanted to say, and maybe any of you have experience here, Devin is making a lacto-fermented, or was, making a lacto-fermented mustard, and was wondering about the other spices, like onion, paprika, celery seed. Put it in before the ferment or after the ferment or both. I would, if you're going to do this on an ongoing basis, I would definitely do an A-B test. I would do a little before and a little after, and see whether or not there's a fundamental difference. Most pickling recipes have you put this stuff in before, and I think a lot of that might be that a lot of the old school pickling recipes are based on some of the antimicrobial or anti-bad microbial effects that a lot of these spices have. But you know, if you're not worried about that, I don't really know whether anyone has done the kind of overarching study of what it tastes like when you add it before versus what you add after. And you also said that you noted that when you were cooking soup and you added vinegar to it, that the acidity from the vinegar went away, but the acidity in other things doesn't. It just makes perfect sense to me because vinegar is, as we know, one of the very few volatile organic cooking acids. That makes sense? Anyone? Sense?
I prefer cooking on acid more than cooking with acid.
Oh my God, have you done that?
No. But in my dreams, I feel like it would be a lot more fun these days.
I've never taken any sort of hallucinogen, but I just don't think I would react well.
I don't know. So maybe we all just trip together and see what happens? I mean, it might be a fun experiment.
I don't know. I've never tried it. Nastasia is not interested in hallucinogens, right? Or you are? I can't remember.
No.
You're supposed to
have a lot of them.
Part of your brain or something.
I don't know. I just don't know that I don't know that I would come back from it. But are we mentioning? So one of the reasons Nastasia doesn't want to come back right now to this side of the country is that in one of these major storms we had, because her house is right on the Sound, and the Sound, the Long Island Sound, is a relatively protected body of water. So having your house on the Sound is a lot different from having it on the Atlantic Ocean, where you can get where you get pummeled on the regular, right? No one expects that their house is right on the Sound is going to get obliterated, and yet somehow some wind kicked up in one of these cyclone situations over here that we had, and
it was the blizzard 2 weeks ago.
Wiped just like whaboosh and soaked all of your stuff, right?
Yeah, broke the windows, and now all the windows or the windows facing the Sound are boarded up. So yeah. my friend went there yesterday, and she was like, yeah, it's pretty depressing in here with the windows boarded, and they can't fix them until it gets hot there. So I don't know when that is.
Why are they grouted in with cement?
Yeah. And so I was like, well, maybe I should spend a couple more weeks here, because I don't know, looking at boarded up windows inside alone would be super sad.
Why do you think that we deserve anything more than that?
No, I considered that, Dave. I knew that you would want me there, but everyone's telling me there's no point.
Yeah. And are you allowed to tell about the dream in which I was unreasonable?
Yeah, two nights ago, I dreamt that Dave made me make a football-sized field of fudge, and he walked away to take care of his family, some family.
You said
emergency.
My dog was causing problems. I had to go.
No,
take
it was something
major.
Family related. It was definitely something like your kids or your dogs. And the fudge seized up before I could make it all the way around the football field to stir it. So all the nuts had just stayed on one side of the thing. And then Dave came back and was like, the hell, like you're supposed to stir the entire thing and all this. And I woke up like frantically, like, oh my God, I really effed that up. And then I called Dave and told him, and literally his response was, well, why didn't you think of another solution to like make sure that the nets were spread more, like as if it were a real thing.
I played right into it. I was like, I felt like I would have disappointed her if I didn't play. I was like, here's what I said exactly. I was like, Nastasia, listen, if you didn't think it was going to work, you knew we were making a football field of fudge. You knew we were doing this. You saw me show up. You saw the ingredients go into the football field. If you didn't think it was going to work, why didn't you say something then? Why do you wait?
Yeah, but then I was like, why did you run off to go take care of it? You should have, we got in a whole
5 minutes. You couldn't just stir the fudge for 5 minutes. 5 minutes. You ruined the whole football field. 5 minutes.
So that's what it's like, even in dreams.
Yeah. Normally, I recommend against sharing dreams with other people because they tend to be like boring and way more nonsensical than you think. But for you guys, I recommend not sharing because it leads to actual arguments. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. So on the way out, since we have some chefs and other people, Chef Joanna, listener, says, and sometimes into the chat room, which we always appreciate. Can Dave please comment on ceramic knives, yay or nay? They make me nervous. I have like some petties, some pairings that but they make me nervous because I always feel like I can't resharpen them, like when stuff happens to them. And I've broken the tip off of one, but Wiley loves them. Wiley, he has a slicer he uses sometimes. He loves the ceramics for the price to slice ratio. Well, what do you think, Joel?
I don't keep things that are too precious or fragile. In fact, probably 10 years ago, I stopped spending money on fancy knives because I just I don't take good care of them. I have a good amount of utility knives and some Corin style stuff that I've held on to over the years. And I buy the ones that are a little bit less expensive. And then when I'm done with them, I just buy another one because they're like 70, 80 bucks. After 2 or 3 years, I get another one. But the ceramic knives, I had one bad experience when I was a young cook and I lobbed off my knuckle with it. So I pretty much decided at that point that I don't ever want to be near one ever again.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hey, here's something else interesting. You know, how, I don't know whether if anyone's heard this show, like a lot of them, when I do talk about knife sharpening, I always mention my dislike for the asymmetrical sharpening that some Japanese Western knives have, where they'll have a different angle on one side of the blade than the other. I either prefer completely symmetrical old school European or completely traditional chisel grind that they have, you know, in Japanese knives. And Wiley was like, well, you know, if you just take some time the first time you use it and then just keep going on one side of a Japanese Western, you can turn a Japanese Western into a chisel grind because they're so thin, it's actually not that hard to do it. And so he's been, all of his Japanese Western thin ones are sharpened chisel grind, which
or he pushed them through a 90-10 from a 70-30.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And so, and I think he's even the only issue with the Japanese Western is that like, if you want to go a true zero on the flat side, it needs to be concave, on the bottom so that the spine edge and then the blade edge can rest to really take it off. So most people do a very slight relief on the back side just because their knives aren't like concave enough to sharpen like a true chisel. But I think anyone who I like know and deal with a lot, whose kind of opinions, who don't take opinions from other people without like actually thinking about it themselves, none of them really love the asymmetrical grinds. They're just, because I'll tell you this, there's kind of like people who buy very sharp knives, but then don't want to take the time to sharpen them. Anything that gets in your way of sharpening is bad. So if you have a sharpening system that is too complicated for you to use on a regular basis, then I would rather you use something that makes your knife slightly less sharp, right? But that you could do on the regular, because the integral of sharpness over time will be a much larger number if you can, like on the regular, keep it relatively sharp than if you take it up to some high level of sharpness once a year. And so like, you know, I do I would say, you know, on knives that I use a lot, I almost, you know, weekly I'll touch them up. I'm not talking professionally. I'm talking home use. You know what I mean? I'll weekly hit them up or so. Some knives, the carbon ones that sharpen really well but are a pain in the butt because they rust, I'll sharpen them every time I use them, right? So I'll just sharpen them every time I use them because it's not that hard. So getting a knife that's easy to sharpen and getting a sharpening regime that you can actually tolerate, that you can live with, that's fast and livable, is more important, I think, than getting the ultimate sharpness out of a knife. I don't know. It's my
25 That almost sounds like health advice. That was good.
Yeah, but don't you agree with me though? Like I have some of these super fancy sharpeners, but it's like a half hour thing. I got to set up the base. I got to do the soaking. I got to set the angles. I got the different with the guides and all this other stuff. And
you know, I don't like knives that are too sharp, because when you put too fine of an edge on it, it does that thing where it sticks into the cutting board.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Also, I think a lot of people, when they sharpen and they get it too sharp, remember, there's absolute sharpness, and then there's like, how good are you for the angles that you choose? I don't go hyper narrow on my angles. I prefer a slightly stronger edge. So, you know, if you're using one of these super modern steels and you're going to a very, very, very small angle on the bottom of the blade, yeah, I mean, A, that sharpness isn't going to get maintained that long, and B, you're going to stick. Although I do like it when my traditional carbon Japanese ones, I take them to that level of sharpness where it's just like stupid sharp, where like it'll cut you if you look at it wrong. I mean, I do like that. You know what I mean? Anyways, my feelings on sharpening. All right, well, Joel, thanks for coming on and answering some pasta questions. And so I know we have a lot of questions for next week, but hopefully they're ones that I can answer without having to pull in experts. So maybe we'll just rip through some next week. John and Nastasio will try to keep me on track, maybe.
Yep, we can do that.
All right. Thanks, Joel. Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening!